I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat & Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Black culture through the complicated lens of agriculture. We speak to Carla Hall about her uncompromising soul food recipes.
And I was like, what am I doing? Why am I changing my family's history for another culture?
We also hear from Gabriela Rodriguez at Harlem Grown's Youth Farm Uptown.
About empowerment and, you know, community resilience building through this work. Food is kind of just a vehicle.
Leah Penniman addresses feeling like an outsider in the farming community.
I could count on my two hands the number of people who appeared to be POC, people of color. Mm-hmm. And so I literally would go around little slips of paper and say, hey, meet at 1 o'clock under this tree so we can talk.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian foods. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on an aspect of Asian cuisine or culture by having a conversation with a passionate people from the world of Asian food. This episode, we're going to lean heavier on the culture side as we discuss the evolution of Chinatown, inspired by Elaine Chen's article in the New York Times titled, As Manhattan's Chinatown Changes, Food Vendors Keep a Bit of the Old with the New. And I've linked the article on our Facebook and Instagram if you'd like to give it a read. This article really struck a chord with me. I remember when I lived in Long Island between the ages of 4 and 8, and my parents and I had a ritual of driving into Chinatown about every 2 to 3 weeks when we needed to replenish the Chinese cooking essentials that just didn't exist deep in Long Island. So I was usually stuck in the back seat of a stuffy car, getting progressively more carsick as we hit traffic, but immediately forgot all the negative feelings once my parents let me loose in the snack aisles of Chinatown's grocery stores, where afterwards I would return with chocolate-filled panda cookies to show off to my friends back in school. Now, living in North Brooklyn, I still make the monthly trek over to Manhattan's Chinatown whenever I'm craving steamed rice rolls or I'm out of black vinegar or to source all of my ingredients for a dumpling-making party. In her article, Elaine notes that the population of Chinatown, one of Manhattan's few historic immigrant working-class neighborhoods left, is shifting. So, how are the people in the food businesses there adjusting? And to talk about all of that is the writer herself, Elaine Chen, as well as Nemois Wilson Tang. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi. Good
to be
here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. So a little about our guests. Elaine Chen is an editor of digital storytelling at the New York Times. She joined the Times about a year ago from WNYC Public Radio, where she worked on a podcast called Only Human. Wilson Tang is the owner and operator of Nemois Tea Parlor, which is considered the first dim sum parlor in New York City. And Wilson took over the business from his uncle in 2010 and has expanded the Nemois footprint to include a Philly location and Nemois Nolita, a contemporary offshoot in New York City. And Wilson is our resident Chinatown expert, as he also lives there, a few blocks away from Nemois Tea Parlor with his wife and two kids. So Elaine, let's start with hearing about how you came up with this article idea.
It's funny hearing your story about going to Chinatown as a kid, because that's also how it started for me a long time ago. When I was growing up in Baltimore, there is a decent-sized Chinese community in D.C., but there definitely wasn't the same kind of concentration of food there. So my family would drive from Baltimore up to New York every few weeks.
Even more seems dedicated.
Like, yeah, I really hated it, actually. I mean, it sounds like you found your salvation in the snack aisle in Chinatown, but I did not get such a pleasure, and I did not enjoy it because I felt like it was a long drive and not worth it. Because as a little kid, it was super crowded and noisy, yeah. And people are yelling, and it just wasn't that enjoyable for me. But now that, well, actually, not even, there's like one more sort of a step in my relationship with Chinatown. When I got older, I appreciated it, though, a lot more, that even though I was growing up in Baltimore, I could still get these specialty food items. And so mm-hmm. then I chose to live in Chinatown in my 20s, and I really loved it. I mean, I loved just having all of that great cheap food when you're like in your 20s and struggling to make ends meet. It's so nice to be able to get this comforting, cheap food at all hours.
We don't use cheap, though. It's inexpensive.
Sorry.
Marketing genius over here.
Right.
It's
value driven. Value driven. I'm just trying to think of some other word. That's true. Yeah. I mean, because it's very good quality food,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Well, some of the best, actually.
Yeah. I mean, and it's freshly made. It was made just then. So if you bought it in some other neighborhood, it would be packaged or frozen. But in Chinatown, it would have just been made the morning that you're eating it. So that's why it's really great. So I appreciated it in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And then now I go to Chinatown, even though I don't live there. I go there every week because my daughter goes to Chinese school there. And over that time, from when I was a kid to being in my 20s to going there now, when I'm not in my 20s, I'm a little bit older than that, I noticed the change. That when I was a kid going there, it was really hard to walk on the sidewalks because it would just be so packed.
That crowded.
So packed, and there would be so many blocks. I mean, it felt like, of course, as a little kid, like blocks and blocks, never ending, of all these shops that my mom would want to go to. And they're still there, but they're really not as many. I feel like the main area now for food is very concentrated on a particular block, actually, of Mott Street now, between Grand and Hester, is really where a lot of them are. There's still some others in other parts of the neighborhood, but that kind of density is really exists mainly on that block now.
Mm-hmm. And so it's shrunk.
It's shrunk, yeah. Mm. So noticing that change that made me feel very sad, I wanted to understand it a little bit more.
Okay.
And also another thing that I felt like as a journalist is that, Chinatown gets written about a lot because it's an iconic neighborhood, but I feel like a lot of coverage of Chinatown is a little superficial and you don't really get a sense of personalities. You'll get like a funny quote here and there from people, but you don't get to know the people. So that was something else that I really wanted to do in this story. So focus on the food vendors who were there specifically, although I do love Nam Wah and the restaurants there, but I feel like there is a decent amount of attention to the restaurants and not as much attention to the food vendors there. So I wanted to focus on that. And also make it so people would know the vendors themselves and their stories. So give a little bit more background about them. And that's what I wanted to do in the story.
That's excellent. You definitely cover a good number of intimate profiles in your article. So what was the experience like putting the piece together? Did you already know who you wanted to speak to?
No, I mean, the only idea I had is that I wanted to cover a range of products and goods. But I didn't have any specific people in mind, and it was a real challenge. I mean, Wilson was like one of maybe a handful of people that I spoke to who were like peripherally related to those industries because I couldn't get people directly. I tried a few times.
Were they hesitant to talk? How did you reach out?
You know, my mom would say, it's like, why didn't you study more in Chinese school? So part of it is my Mandarin is not great. I think another part of it, though, too, is that there's just very little incentive for people to talk to a reporter, let alone a reporter who's writing for an English language publication. Any kind of media coverage always invites a little more scrutiny. And sometimes that scrutiny is not welcome. And even if everything is totally fine, you just don't want to deal with that trouble. And then there's, you know, the typical upside for a business to talk to a media outlet is that then it will bring in more clientele and it'll drum up more business. But I'm not writing for their primary clientele. So there's just not a clear...
What do they get from
talking
this?
To me? And, you know, maybe they are aware of other times when English media has gone to Chinatown and the terrible job that has been done sometimes in those stories. You know, I totally sympathize with subjects when they get approached by a reporter that you don't know what's going to be said and what the angle is going to be and how your words can be twisted. I know Wilson sometimes, even though he can totally do a ton of English media, has probably not always been happy with like the story that results from those. So even scarier than when it's not in your language and you don't really know what the narrative is going to be and you're just getting by and,
totally
you know,
fair.
You're struggling with your own business to then take on this additional risk.
So how did you succeed in getting those profiles?
It was by talking to people like Wilson and other people in the neighborhood who would connect me with other people who were connectors who could then do an introduction. Because basically I needed someone who spoke the right... Because even if I had my Mandarin down pat, I don't know if that would have worked because I don't speak Toisanese or Cantonese. Mm. So that, you know, it still feels more removed even if you speak Mandarin. So finding the right people who spoke the right dialect and who are also... known personally, that I think was really important in letting people sort of feel a little more comfortable in talking to me because there was someone else in the neighborhood saying like, she's okay, she's gonna do a decent job.
I think it's all of those things. But the main purpose or the main focus is the language barrier, of course. Second is, I think these vendors are just humble in nature, so. They're just like, it's fine.
It's a Chinese thing.
So it's such a Chinese thing to be like, it's fine. Don't worry about it. You know, it's no one wants to hear about this.
Aww.
You know, so I think that's definitely another component of it. And it's the third thing is just rapport. I think I have a good rapport with a lot of the businesses in Chinatown. And
is that through Namwa and your relationship, like sourcing food from them?
That and just. I think I'm just generally a nice guy, and like I say hi to everyone, and I show respect, and I'm a person they would look up to. Oh, is that okay to do? I'm like, yeah. Talk to her, or like talk to this person, and that's how some of these connections end up working out in Chinatown. You gotta know someone.
Totally fair.
Yeah.
And Elaine, from your article, each profile is inspiring. And each viewpoint is different. Could you give us some examples of how the food vendors are adjusting? What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. Also, the differences. I think some of the sidewalk vendors, I mean, it's already really hard as a sidewalk vendor because you're just out there all day. But also, they just don't have as much capital that they can try out other things because I think their margins are probably much smaller. So for them, they're more just... I'm just going to ride this out as long as I can. And then at a certain point, it just doesn't make sense anymore. And then I'm closing up. But in the meantime, I mean, the thing that was really interesting in talking to them, and there was actually one or two other sidewalk vendors that I talked to, but I didn't end up being able to publish. I mean, they still were able to raise families on this. I mean, Moi Trong, who is a fruit seller that I spoke to, I mean, she has four kids. Two of her kids are in college. One's at Columbia. One's at the University of Richmond.
Incredible.
Yeah, there's a little bit of like Asian pride. I want to show like, hey, you know, these people have sort of lived the American dream from their business in Chinatown.
She runs that corner too.
Yeah, with us, because also her sister.
Yeah, like across the street.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've expanded. I mean, I think probably they started out with a smaller stand and now she's got like three or four big tables of stuff.
Yeah. And behind the scenes, like even getting those carts is like a thing. Like there's only a certain amount of licensing that's allowed in New York. So like that cart is valuable. It's in a sense where like that sticker, that permit that allows them to sell fruits or vegetables is a big component of their business. So like to have like three or four of them, They're doing. Yeah,
she knows. What
she's been there for 20 years. Yeah,
she's been there for a long time. And the mom always is in the
who's
truck.
Who's 83? Yeah. I cannot believe it. They are from Vietnam. Yeah. And she's 83, and she will be there with her daughter in the super cold weather. Yeah.
I always love seeing that because the mom will always be in the passenger side of like the truck, but like if they needed change, like she would pull out her wad and say, "Oh, you need change? I got it."
Oh my God.
So it's always like I always remember seeing these vendors, but like, you know, it's they're all these like little intricate like little things that they do, and that particular family I remember a lot because I get stuff like the last minute things. I would always go there. They have the best product also. So,
Huge variety. Yeah. Some of the most exotic, hot pink looking fruits.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was really nice that I'm surprised actually that my editor decided to keep in is that my uncle who lives in Missouri, where there are far fewer Asian businesses, had said, he's older, he's in his 80s, that he would love to taste cherimoya one more time before he passes away. And so my cousin who was visiting brought one back from him, and he bought the cherimoya from Moi Trung. And my uncle was like really surprised. He didn't think that my cousin was actually going to have one, and was really happy. I mean, I was just thinking of like Proust when he talks about like being taken back by like the taste of a madeleine, and a cherimoya was that for my uncle, because my uncle growing up in Taiwan had been able to have it, and he just hadn't had it in decades, and it was really meaningful for him to have this like delicious memory brought back through the fruit that Moi Trung sells.
That's amazing. That's a great personal story. And there's another one with Paul Ng.
Yeah, and so Paul is also like Louis Wu, whose family runs the Hong Kong Mart, where these are shopkeepers who have a lot more capital. Mm. Both of them, I know Paul Ng's family owned property, and Louis Wu, his family's company has multiple branches in other parts of the New York metro area. And so for them, it's a little bit different. It's easier for them to shift. They've gone to school in the United States too, so they know more how to attract a broader audience as opposed to just the residents in Chinatown. So they have plans. They have plans on how they're going to change. Also, the same with the Wong family that owns Aquabest. Freeman and his brother Stephen, they speak like Toi San and Cantonese, but they also went to school here too. So they also know. I mean, that's how they have their relationships with restaurants like Blanca and Del Posto, is because they know how to market themselves because they're very familiar and comfortable with it.
Yeah, they're like second, third gen.
Yeah, yeah. And then so for Paul Ng, it's really funny, though, because he grew up in his family's shop, Fong Ng Tu, which was one of the oldest tofu shops, but he hated it, actually. And the reason why Fong Ng Tu closed is because he had no interest in carrying it on, actually. Huh. But I did ask him when I was interviewing him if he had any memory of any positive memories of working in the shop, and he did have this really funny story about working in the shop when he was in high school.
The stuff that we make, especially the rice cake, we also sell to the Filipino community, and they know it as puto. The word puto, however, is a Spanish word for something else. So whenever some Filipinos would come in and have no idea what we sell, they would ask, "What do you sell here?" And we say, "Oh," and I recognize them as Filipino, and I say, "We sell puto, you know, we sell white puto, which is white rice cake, and brown puto, which is brown rice cake." One evening, a family came in, and they asked this question, and I said, "We sell white puto, and we sell puto. We sell white puto, and we sell brown puto." Then I realized they were not Filipino, and that they were Hispanic, and they were like, "What? Where do you hide this? Where do you put this puto?" And I was like, "Oh, you're not Filipino, are you?" "No."
How old were you?
Like 16.
All right, what a hustler.
Yeah, I mean, so that was a funny anecdote that he had. But for the most part, Paul was saying that, you know, his interests were creative. He was a freelance photographer for almost a decade and actually worked in Russia, where he met his wife. So his interests were outside of Chinatown, outside the food business. But he's since come around. Now that he has kids, his life is sort of more stable, and he's interested in maintaining a business as opposed to being constantly sort of freelancing in the creative industries. So that's why he's now thinking about trying, and actually not just thinking about, he is in the midst of opening up a new tofu shop. But he, like Louis Wu, who owns Hong Kong Mart, is thinking it's not going to be a traditional tofu shop because that's just not the customer base that you can rely on anymore. So what he's thinking about is something that would appeal more to people who are kind of into snacking and trying creative takes on traditional Chinese foods like tofu custard. But he's going to put in like sort of unusual toppings that will hopefully appeal to other people beyond just the Chinatown residents. But at the same time, he actually wants to try and maintain a line of traditional soy products too. So we'll see how it goes, because he's trying to sort of straddle both worlds.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
So speaking of iterating on something that is old, Wilson, let's talk about Nem Hua.
Yeah.
You know, in its almost, I guess, like 100 years of operation now. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the 100 year will be next year.
Ooh, 2020. Very 2020, auspicious.
Yeah. So we're going to build around the year, build some programming around next year.
Yeah.
You know, but the celebration for me, you know, not only, you know, it's not really for myself, it's not really for the store. I really want to have the celebration around the community, for this 100-year-old brand in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to work with collaborators and just anyone out there that would fit Chinatown, and work on these collaboratives for next year to really have a big party and give back to the community somehow.
Yeah, and so in your time working at Nem Hua, and also, you know, having like been there before you started taking over, how have you seen it evolve? You know, what factors have you had to adapt to or not change?
I think for us, you know, I was always, change is always inevitable. So I'm always rolling with the change. And, you know, in the past, it's been 8 years already. We've kind of went from full artisanal, like everything was handmade, to partial handmade and partial machine made. We needed to do that a couple of years ago just to keep up with the demand of the product. So while, you know, a lot of our things are still handmade, you know, we have a component of it that is machine made now, that really kind of makes our product line a little more reliable. And we're able to scale that way with more locations.
Yeah. And has your clientele changed?
So I think my clientele has been the usual, being there for so long. You know, the weekdays, we have a strong, like, jury duty crowd. You know, I can just tell when people walk in, it's like if they're in like a suit or like a sports coat,
just call it.
Yeah, they're probably on jury duty, or they're an attorney, or they're someone that's working in an office in the neighborhood. So we get our bankers, our lawyers, our pharmacy technicians, like stuff like that for lunch during the week. And on the weekend, it's a really mixed bag. All walks of life, out of towners, people that lived here years ago and are visiting, tourists, of course.
Yeah. Have you had to expand the menu to cater to like additional preferences or tastes? Or I guess I remember talking to you before, and you introduced the dim sum all day dining concept. So, you know, it wasn't always like that in Nem Hua.
Yeah, so the traditional way is just breakfast, lunch, and brunch. I always had this idea of same story to you guys about taking the car on the weekends, driving out with your parents, fighting the crowd. I always hated that part of China, going into Chinatown, even though I live so close, was where those weekly visits with the whole family, doing the whole dim sum thing. So I always dreamed about having dim sum for dinner, very similar to having tapas at a Spanish restaurant. So all day dim sum was on my brain since day one. And I think we did a pretty good job with it. It's very understandable now to our guests. I typically pitch the idea as tapas, small bites, good with wine or a beer. But, you know, the last 8 years has gone by so quickly, and we actually don't change that often. We have a menu of 50 items, and those items don't really change at all.
Yeah.
I'm curious, actually, Wilson, because I love going to your restaurant, and my husband and I usually bounce back and forth between either eating at Nomar or eating at Jing Feng. Very different dim sum experience. And one time we brought my sister-in-law there. We brought my mother to Nomar.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying that she felt like, oh, but this is the place more for tourists. And I'm just wondering what your perspective is, what your view is on the demographics of your clientele compared to some of the other dim sum places, and who you sort of view as your target, mm-hmm. your target customer.
So I think for me, as Chinese American or American Chinese, I really have a foot in both worlds. I think the Chinese side of me is, you know, I would never fight with another restaurant. And I think the old school way was always, oh, you're doing 350? Oh, I'm going to go 325.
Oh, that's what it's like in mainland China.
Yeah. So I was never that way. And I've always had the mind frame where, you know, I'm not going to compete with those guys that will fight me on the price, nor do I want that customer. I just want, out of the 8 million people that live in New York, I just want that sliver of people that are willing to pay $5 for an order of shrimp dumpling. And I'm just going to ride ride the people that are willing to pay that amount. And I don't want to worry about anyone that's lower or more expensive. And I think with that attitude, we offer like a level of service and quality that, you know, not... Some Chinese people are going to say, oh, that's expensive. Like, we're not going to go there because it's expensive. You can get it cheaper somewhere else. So that's why, like, the dining room, sometimes you don't see that many Chinese people, which I'm actually kind of okay with.
It's a very modern take on things. And Wilson, as a proprietor in Chinatown and as a resident of the neighborhood, do you have, like, similar feelings with Elaine, like that... you know, there's certain changes that you feel nostalgic about?
Well, you know, I think, like I said before, change is inevitable. I really hate it when, like, those mom and pops that's been in the neighborhood forever end up not being able to make it because either their marketing strategy is wrong, or, like, the rent went up, or, like, the customer has changed. But then I'm also very excited to see young Asian Americans come back to Chinatown to open business. So, like, there's plenty of those. You know, on Pell Street, there's a new restaurant that opened called Chino's that serves rotisserie chicken on Pell Street. And on Mott Street, there's a restaurant called Pho Bar that serves Vietnamese pho. In the heart of Chinatown. So as much as there was, like, heartache, like, oh, man, I've been there as a kid, I'm also very excited to see what's next.
And how
are we pushing the envelope, and how do we get kids to come back to Chinatown instead of moving into the suburbs and stuff?
For sure.
I actually have a question about that, too, because I like, also, like, Freeman and Stephen, like, Wong, who are going to be opening up a shop over at the Essex Street.
Yeah. We're in the same market.
In the same market, which looks really cool, and it's going to be very hip, and it's going to be this interesting cultural take. And Freeman also, I felt like, had a very good sort of similar perspective that the second and third generation of Chinatown is going to redefine what it is. But I also find that it's, like, really interesting that the new businesses that open up by Asian Americans who are opening up these cool, hip, sometimes they're fusion, they're really creative. They are almost never catering to working class customers. I mean, because honestly, that customer base is disappearing, and it's just not viable to do that anymore. But I don't know, at the same time, I also am like, I kind of wish that there was, like, that there were opportunities there for serving the working class residents. And that's probably more me being nostalgic and looking too much backwards. I recognize that. But it's just interesting to me that all of the new businesses that open up, especially, like, I mean, I love the, Alma Tea? I can't remember the donut.
The mochi thing.
Yeah, which I love. I mean, totally unaffordable if you're, like, working class to go there on a regular basis, or, like, Egglu, which was really cool and also came out of his nostalgia for, like, Hong Kong cakes, was, like, I think it was, like, $8 or something for, like, the ice cream.
Yeah, you know what, though? I think with my business guy hat on, just like the rents, the real estate tax, and all of those numbers make it. It's hard for.
It's just not
profitable. Yeah, hard to not have to sell that mochi donut for $8 because she's paying so much money in rent. It's hard to survive, and I think when you're an entrepreneur and you're trying to open a business, you know, at least one of the objectives is to make a little money, right?
It.
So
yeah.
I think it's increasingly hard, you know, and there's more, like the minimum wage is $15 an hour now, so like it's stacked up against the restaurant owner or
all
like
these,
the proprietor.
City changes,
bureaucracy, taxes, health department. So I'm on the fence with that, and as much as I love to serve the working class people, it's tough. It's tough to run a business.
Yeah, I mean, something that was really interesting was, I think, one of the property owners there was pointing out too that it's from the property owner's perspective, there's a lot of affordable housing in Chinatown. I mean, it's not most of it, but it's a big chunk of it. And so then there's no flexibility there. There's mm-hmm. very little flexibility there. The flexibility that you have is in the commercial lease. And so that's why then you're just going to charge these businesses more because you got to find some way to now cover your costs now because your property is valued so high.
Yep.
So you can't lease out to a commercial tenant that's not going to give you a lot of revenue to cover, enough revenue to cover those costs.
Right. But, you know, I do have to say, like, in Chinatown, there are still some staples that are mom and pop. The prices are affordable. You know, like, Big Wong on Mott Street is great. I think you can get something in there for, like, $6, like a meal for $6. And there's still, like, these little kind of mom and pop hole in the walls, like Misum on Pell Street. You can get, like, a 3 combination rice for $5. So I think they're out there. You just have to be like a little more savvy into seeking these things out.
Yeah. I think another one of the interesting ideas that I can't remember in which city this has been implemented or they're actually actively discussing it is a tax benefit for owners that have legacy businesses in their property.
Sign me up.
I mean, and I think was it Jan Lee who was saying, you know, he has... what is the business that's in his building?
There's like a tea shop. As a phone store, I think one of them is a cell phone store.
No. There's a restaurant that's been there for decades.
Hop Key.
Yeah. And he's like, you know, shouldn't I get some benefit if I cut a deal that doesn't charge them as much?
Yeah.
Because this is an institution, this business.
And like, if he didn't cut the deal, the restaurant probably wouldn't survive.
Right. Yeah.
So on that note, we're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
This episode has been brought to you by Worldwide Soba, a Japanese noodle production company. Founded by Shuichi Kotani, Worldwide Soba offers noodle consulting services in addition to supplying a variety of tools for wannabe noodle makers. Want to take a class? Worldwide Soba has it. Need a traditional Japanese soba knife? Worldwide Soba has that too. To learn more, visit worldwide-soba.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. And we have Elaine Chen and Wilson Tang here with us. So let's talk about what makes a Chinatown Chinatown. Elaine, what defines Chinatown for you?
I mean, Chinatown, it's very like basics. It's just a place that has a concentration of Chinese people, either mm-hmm. residents or businesses. I think, though, on the other hand, what I think makes Manhattan Chinatown so special, though, is that there are now very few historic urban Chinatowns. I mean, there are definitely lots that are growing in all parts of the United States, especially in strip malls and in suburban areas, because the Chinese population has definitely grown. And it's grown in New York City, too. But Manhattan Chinatown is really special because there have been Chinese who have been living there since the 1800s. And you really can see that. And also, because there's been such a long history there of families living happening there. There's a real range of businesses and institutions there that don't exist in the strip mall in Vegas or whatever, and other Chinatowns, or like even like in the DC Chinatown, which I sort of also saw change growing up there. I mean, there are hardly any residents there anymore. So what I really love about Manhattan Chinatown that you still have there is the range of people that are there. You have people of all ages, old and young, and you have tourists that are there, and there's just this concentration that allows for just like this, the great sounds that are there, especially around the food market and Mott Street. This is a little snippet of it. There was one moment I was just like really caught by, like, I just love this, the energy that's there.
It's so dynamic.
Yeah, and especially the street hawkers. I mean, you just don't have that in New York as much anymore, right? Like the people who are yelling about the wares that they're selling. And you hear a baby crying and...
Do you feel like Chinatown always has to be noisy?
No, I don't think it's about it being noisy, but I do think the noise is an indicator of the concentration and the energy.
Yeah, the experience that you get.
And so if a quiet Chinatown sounds...
That would be like, eerie.
Yeah, like, I like the noise, actually.
Yeah.
Every part of Chinatown you walk through, like, I can just imagine, like, you know, if it's Jing Fong or Nam Wa, like, there's someone yelling outside, like, to get the customers in. You know, further up Mott Street where there's all the commerce, you know, people trying to get your attention to buy their groceries or their vegetables. And just all the, you know, the hustle and bustle of inter-city... the commuter vans that go from Brooklyn's Chinatown to Flushing's Chinatown, all these different noises in Chinatown. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's really unique, I think, it's unique in all of Manhattan to have that kind of range of age, cultural diversity, economic diversity, all in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, the melting pot experience. And then what are some other qualities that are essential to Chinatown? Does it need to have, you know, the types of food you're looking for, certain communities? Like, what else do you guys feel like makes a good Chinatown?
I think, you know, a topic that's less talked about is just the social services. You know, like Elaine mentioned, there's super old people, there's super young people. But I see that happening. Like, there's a lot of, you know, senior citizen homes or associations cater to help out seniors. You know, we have a community center on Mott Street, 62 Mott Street, that helps immigrants with English. You know, my son goes there on both my kids go there on the weekends for Chinese school. And there's a lot of these community-based organizations there to help newly immigrants or immigrants trying to get on their feet.
Yeah, and I guess, Elaine, you brought this up when I spoke to you earlier, to quote the late Peter Kwong, who was a preeminent scholar on America's Chinatowns and Chinese immigration. He had a fear of Chinatown becoming, in quotes, an ethnic theme park without its ethnic population, end quote. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really provocative quote. I actually feel like I might defer to Wilson on this one to let him go first because he's a resident. I mean, because even though I'm fascinated by Chinatown and I'm really trying to learn a lot about it, I feel like someone who lives there and has a business there, it's more important. What do you guys think?
Yeah, is that something you think about or just not so much?
Not so much. You know, I think for me, like I'm sometimes I just get lost by the fact that I'm there constantly. So, you know, sometimes it's just get my work done and see who I can help and then go home and take care of the kids and come back the next day and figure it out again. So I don't have like a real deep thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Peter was a good friend, so it's like...
I mean, I think one thing that I'll throw in there that I think maybe is he'd probably have very strong feelings about is there's definitely some debate in Chinatown about the role that tourism could have in sustaining the neighborhood, as the residents who live there are the Chinese residents that are living there, as those numbers are declining. To what extent could people who don't live in the neighborhood help sustain the businesses that are there? And I think there is some debate about that. There are some people who feel like who are very skeptical of that plan because you know, there's different kinds of tourists there. I mean, I guess in some ways I would be considered a tourist because I don't live there and I go there. But then there are also tourists who come from other countries that are visiting. And if you don't live there, you're not going to buy the same range of things, though. You know, especially if this is part of your trip to New York for the first time, you're probably less likely to buy like a ton of rice or vegetables. Yeah. You're probably going to buy more like a memento. Maybe you might you will try out the food, maybe you'll buy a little snack, but you're not going to get your hair cut there or like have your clothes.
It's the only place I can find proper like pork bone for my broths.
So tourism would, it's good to have a various streams of income and try and cater to a range of constituencies, but you have to sort of keep in mind about how much of a range and the kind of services and products that they're going to buy, and that's not going to be the same a tourist as, as someone who lives there.
Yeah, that's a good point to kind of bring it back to the businesses, the food purveyors shifting their businesses.
Right. I mean, that's what, partly that why have, it's harder for the food purveyors to shift. Like it's going to be harder for them to serve the tourists because tourists are not going to buy a ton of like dragon fruit or whatever. They might just buy one, but they'll still go to restaurants. And so restaurants, they'll might have to change their menu if they're going to cater to tourists, but, it's a little bit harder for a food purveyor to shift. I mean, the other thing, when I saw that quote, actually, the first thought that came to mind, again, was like thinking again about Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown, which was so bizarre to me because, I mean, when I grew up around Baltimore, I knew D.C. when there were a lot of people who lived there and a lot of businesses there, but then I lived there again about 20 years later. There are very few residents who live there now, but there's still laws that require that some of the signage is in Chinese. So the Hooters has a sign in Chinese and Starbucks is in Chinese, but it's so bizarre because there are almost no Chinese there though. So it's very weird. There's this big Chinatown gate. There's a big Chinese gate, but there are very few Chinese residents who live there anymore.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, there is a range of Chinatowns. It doesn't always need to be working class, but to your point, totally understand why this historic community is so rare and we should kind of cherish it at the same time, although change is inevitable to your point. Yeah. So also I have kind of like a more fun question on food and what you guys buy in Chinatown and the only things you can really get there. To stay, like, for me, you know, authentically Chinese, I'm like, I need my black vinegar for my dumplings. I need my pork bones. I need the black fungus. No one else eats black fungus. So my question is to identify with your cultural Chinese heritage. Do you guys believe you have to eat certain foods to stay authentically Chinese? And you both have kids. So are there Chinese foods you make them eat and that you really want them to love, even though they might be rejecting it?
I think we have a hodgepodge in our household. There's definitely taco night, you know, but like, we, you know, we'll whip up something like authentically American Chinese. Like my kids love like orange chicken and we would make that at home with fried rice. Always some Chinese vegetables. But We mix it up at home, but I think for shopping in Chinatown, I do a lot of it at Hong Kong supermarket, and it's just great for us because we can buy like a piece of fish for that night, and just it'll be fresh.
So fresh
with just ginger, a little black bean, and a little oil, and steam it. And these are things that we make at home.
Yeah, that's a very Chinese preparation.
Very just easy. I've seen my mom do it a million times. And we're trying to teach these traditions to the kids now, too. You know, it's a little hard, but we're trying our best.
How old are your kids, Wilson?
Six and five.
Oh, okay, yeah. So it's actually pretty close. Yeah, my kids are 2 and 7. The thing I struggle with them is that my daughter groans every time I give her chopsticks. I'm like, no, you've got to use these. You've got to. You are 7.
Oh man, holding chopsticks, I would drop them dramatically on the table.
Yeah, I insist on it, and I'm like, before you turn 8, you've got to know how to use chopsticks, and you cannot use these little kitty ones anymore. Yeah. But it's funny, though, because I was thinking about this question because I actually do have feelings on foods that you should like if you're going to be like,
give us some
Chinese American. Yeah. It was funny. At one point when I was writing my bio for you, I was saying that I will judge you by how cleanly you eat the meat and cartilage off a bone, because I feel like it's very not a Chinese thing or an immigrant thing to leave so much meat on the bone. And so that's something sometimes I harp on my kids about. I'm like, no, that drumstick's not done. There's still too much meat there. You have to finish that, and you should eat the crunchy bone too.
Yeah.
So I feel that way. Using chopsticks, eating rice,
the saying? The number of grains of rice you leave in the bowl will end up being like pock marks on your face.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mom.
Is that true? Is that just for Joy Luck Club? I feel like I do remember that from Joy Luck Club, but I don't know if that's actually true. So I feel like it's about eating. It's especially about eating a range of meats and not being grossed out by seeing the fact that you are eating an animal. I think that it's a very mainstream American thing to make it super processed, so you can't even tell that it is meat anymore. And I feel like in Chinese culture and other cultures too, you don't hide that.
It's more healthy approach.
It's the whole fish. Yep, the fish is staring at you because that is a fish. And the duck is there with all of the bones and the skin, and you don't get grossed out by it. If anything, it looks more appealing because you see the whole thing.
Yeah, I guess my kids wouldn't be freaked out about that because they walk around Chinatown all
day long. Good,
that's
good.
It's normal. Yeah,
yeah.
I like hearing that. Yeah. I feel proud about that. But also, to your point, in other cultures, the nose-to-tail eating is more promoted.
Right, right.
So it's an American problem then.
it's kind of an American thing, I guess, yeah. One time my daughter sort of made a face because we had bought chicken and there was still a little bloody and you could see the veins, and I was like, no, that's good. You got to eat it.
Yeah.
So those sort of things make me... I'm fighting against that. But at the same time, I'm struck by the fact that my family's from Taiwan. If I lived in Taiwan, this would not be an issue. It would not matter. If she didn't want to eat that kind of stuff, it didn't matter. It would not make her less Taiwanese. It's only an issue that you have being in America, especially being a second generation, that you feel like, oh, I've got to cling to this. And this is one of the indicators that I'm still connected.
Yeah.
But if you lived there, there would be no question. Right, and it wouldn't be an issue for you.
Yeah, I think for us immigrants, it's just the difference is so stark. Whereas living in Taiwan or living in China, I'm sure they have their own set of challenges and dealing with change. But maybe eating meat from the bone is not one of them.
Right. Or, if they had a preference for white meat, that wouldn't make them less Taiwanese. But here, I'm like, if you prefer white meat, I'm like, who are you?
That's fun. All right. So I'm going to end this podcast with a question on, future looking. What do you think the future of Chinatown will look like, and what would you like it to look like?
So I actually like the way Chinatown looks now. It's in the midst of change. I think it's been in the midst of change for quite a few years. We throw around that ugly word gentrification. I'm trying my best to kind of slow it down. But I like where we are. I think there was a lull of, just a lot of commercial space being available. But I see more business coming into Chinatown. I see the community rallying behind each other to make it a more vibrant place. I see the parks getting cleaner, the old grannies being taken care of better. I think there's a big push for Chinatown's future, with the the younger kids coming in to ignite some business.
Right. And us just having conversations like this, kind of bringing attention to it.
And just collaborating with each other. Like there's a bunch of Asian chefs in Chinatown now, and like we're all trying to work together to bring each other up.
And the work of the nonprofit organizations in Chinatown, like All Deaf and AFI, that are trying to maintain a certain stock of affordable housing and also support businesses in the community, too.
That's great. So I really look forward to, you know, what Chinatown is going to look like in the next year and beyond.
Same. Ditto.
Well, thank you so much, guys, for joining us. And now, dear listeners, instead of ending this episode with quick-fire questions, we're going to do something different and ask you, our listeners, to share your thoughts. We're posing the same question we asked Elaine and Wilson, that is, to identify with your cultural heritage. Do you believe that you have to eat certain foods to stay authentic? To be able to say you are Chinese, Japanese, Mexican, Italian, or just American, whatever your heritage. If yes, what are examples of those foods? And if no, why not? So please send us a short audio voicemail with your thoughts. You can just record a short clip on your phone or your computer and email that to feastmeetswest@heritageradionetwork.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Well, that's all from us, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.